Yeah, the
complete out there.
Precisely. So we tried to make the follow-up argument to that Ahasuerus's insecurity was really a reflection of somebody who didn't have a very strong sense of self. When I say not a very strong sense of self, I mean a very weak sense of self. And Mordechai, who, you know, we go back many, many generations, we know where he's from, his father, his grandfather, his great-grandfather, a person with a lot of roots and a very clear sense of identity. And the difference is, you know, really could not be more clear. Mordechai is able to be the only person who doesn't go along with the fawning over Haman and ingratiating yourself to the, you know, the person who's popular today. And on the other hand, you know, Ahasuerus is, you know, forget about being able to stand on his own. He's a very suggestible person. Somebody says to him, you know what, your wife defied you publicly, you have to, you know, kill her. And you go along with that.
Right.
You know, you kill a whole, you know, thousands, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of people. For what reason? Not really a good reason. Okay, you know, that's something very, very suggestible about him, and that typically comes with insecurity. So I mentioned at the end last week that today I was going to introduce what I like to call a little bit of a conspiracy theory that I have. I'm not a very conspiratorial person at all, but this is about as conspiratorial as I get about what's really happening in the second half of the Megillah. And in particular, the question that I wanted to respond to is something that I think we probably have all thought about at one point or another, is the fact that for some strange reason, Esther, when she seems to have a golden opportunity to ask Ahasuerus to save the Jewish people, you know, and let's not forget, she was very nervous about going because she hadn't seen him in well over a month. She says she doesn't really have an ongoing relationship with Ahasuerus. It won't surprise any of you, you know, that Ahasuerus spends most of his time with other women around the palace. He's not that kind of person that he's asking Esther, you know, on a daily or weekly basis, you know, how are things going for you here? It must be really quite a change. You know, there really is no ongoing relationship. And she tells Mordechai in no uncertain terms that if she's going to go in front of the king, so the likelihood is that she'll be killed, unless Ahasuerus takes the royal scepter and he lowers it as a pardoning gesture. The default is that anybody who comes in without an appointment to see the king is actually subject to the death penalty. So you would think that, thank God, you know, he greets her very warmly and says, you know, how can I help you? So nice to see you. How have you been? You know, which is very telling in its own right. She doesn't take advantage of that moment. This is a very impulsive person. This is a very mercurial person. Dealing with somebody like that, you don't really know what tomorrow is going to bring, let alone an hour from now. So why is it that Esther hesitates? She doesn't hesitate just once. She hesitates twice. You remember at the first party, she says, so we'll try this again tomorrow. Question number one. Question number two, I think an equally strange and puzzling thing is that instead of speaking directly with Ahasuerus, a private setting, she somehow wants Haman to be there. You know, this is a famous passage in the Talmud. The Talmud is discussing this question. Talmud raises this question. What was Esther thinking? Like, why would she possibly invite Haman? And the Talmud presents eight different answers. You know, and one of the things that we all like to tell our students is when you have a question that has eight different answers and not one answer, it's because, you know, none of them are really perfect. And obviously, there's a lot left to be desired. There's actually a little bit of a humorous addendum to that passage in the Talmud, where one of the rabbis who participate in this debate meets Eliyahu Hanavi, Elijah the prophet, you know, is associated with, you know, being this the ultimate referee on all unanswered questions, and says to Eliyahu, you know, which answer was right? You know, we really had it out there today. And he says, oh, all of them, you know. There's an element of all of them. So one of those answers, actually, before I was even aware of this Gemara, I sort of thought this was the right approach. I just wanted to try to develop it. So just bear that in mind. You know, what exactly is Esther trying to achieve? The second point is, this has a little bit to do with the context. I often think to myself this time of year that Esther was in a very difficult position, not just once it was established that the Jews were going to be killed, but long before that, from day one. See, if I guess it would be good, you know, if Mrs. Stein knew that her predecessor in the math department you know, had been summarily executed by the administration, you know, for you know, in insignificant offense, you know, it would make the job very unsettling.
Say the least.
Yeah, you wouldn't really want that kind of a job. And as we know, Esther didn't really want that kind of a job. I think it's important to psychologically place ourselves somewhat in Esther's position. She knows that she's dealing with somebody who's capable of killing his wife, killing the queen. And she knows that he's capable of doing this largely because he's an alcoholic and largely because he's completely impulsive. You really, in that kind of a position in life, you really cannot be taking too much for granted. It's a very unadmirable situation in which to be entering a job. And I think that's something that Esther lives with, and I think that's important to keep a little bit on background. So what I wanted to try to suggest as a reading of the entire second half of the Megillah, essentially, the middle and the second half of the Megillah, is that Esther actually had a very deliberate plan in mind, and that is that she was going to try to implicate Haman as her lover, as being romantically involved with her. And I wanted to try to demonstrate, I think, three or four pieces of evidence that one may find to support this obviously very radical thesis in the Megillah, that indeed Esther was trying to implicate Haman, and then of course the thinking being, he's killed a wife before, he'll probably kill me, but he'll kill Haman as well, and that will solve the problem. Remember, this is not really something that he feels strongly about. So if you can remove Haman, who's in every sense the instigator and the driving force here, then maybe Esther realizes this is going to be her way to try to save the Jewish people. The last words that Esther says before going into the the palace to see the king is v'cha'asher avadati avadati avadati. In the Megillah, is a very common word. It with an aleph, it means that and I will be killed and. As I will be killed, or in the event that I will be killed, so I will be killed. In other words, it seems from her instinctive response that she recognizes that, what I would say, either way, she's going to be losing her life. If Achashverosh refuses to grant her an audience, so that will be the end of her. And if even Achashverosh grants her an audience, what I'm suggesting is that she was undertaking a plan that she thought either way would certainly result in her own demise. If this is true, we can very well appreciate why Esther continues to invite Haman in a very unusual gesture into a highly intimate setting with the king. Right? The idea that she has some kind of relationship with this man that Achashverosh is somehow unaware of would be very unsettling to Achashverosh. Small wonder that Achashverosh is unable to sleep that night, right? Balayla hahu nadadash nas hamelech. One of the things that he may be considering is the idea that his wife is involved with his prime minister in a very particular way. I think that you get an insight, by the way, into Achashverosh's psychology when, at the critical moment in the seventh chapter, you know, when Achashverosh is been informed by Esther that somebody is attempting to eradicate the Jewish people, he comes back and Haman is in a compromised position right next to Esther. And the words out of his mouth are, Hagam lichbosh es hamalka imi babayis. Are you going to be intimate with her right in front of me? And even if you're doing this in general, do you have the gall to do this right in front of me? You could tell that this has been very, very much on his mind. So, you know, when Esther invites Haman to the first party, and Achashverosh is there, and he doesn't immediately react, so Esther presumably has to up the ante and, you know, try it again. And that's already the time when you see Achashverosh beginning to be a little bit uncomfortable about Haman. Remember, it's that night that Haman comes in the middle of the night. Haman's going to say, "Hang Mordechai," and we know that Ahasuerus sort of preempts all of this by saying, you know, there's somebody I really want to answer, knowing full well, there's somebody I really want to honor, knowing full well that from Haman's point of view, the person that Haman is going to think that Ahasuerus is talking about is himself. So Ahasuerus is messing with Haman, and I think that it's quite obvious that the reason that he's needling him and toying with him is that there's now this very uncomfortable feeling that Ahasuerus has. You know, why, it's not like I see Esther that often. Why are you there? And I think it's highly suggestive of the fact that Ahasuerus did actually have this seed planted in his mind. By the following day, of course, with these seeds planted, when Esther really does come out and say it, the very first words of Ahasuerus' mouth has nothing to do with the Jews. Ahasuerus never says anything about, you know, it's really terrible what you wanted to do to the Jews and how you tricked me and you got me drunk that time and, you know, I wasn't really thinking clearly. All he could say is, you're going to steal my wife? It's the only thing that he's thinking about. And if you know Ahasuerus, that is what he would be concerned about. He's not concerned.
Would that be what any husband would think if he sees somebody in a compromising position with his wife?
I would agree. I don't deny it. I think that it fits in with this with this general approach in a very clear way. So that if all this is true, you can readily appreciate how Esther leveraged something that was obviously a very negative thing about her position, namely the fact that she's quite aware that her husband is prepared to kill her, but what she's able to do is to take that liability or take that vulnerability and transform it into something different altogether. Meaning, she says, okay, maybe he will kill me, but at least I can be of service even in my death if I'm able to bring down Haman with me. And in that respect, I think that Esther is a classic example of somebody who was able to take something which, by definition, was very uncomfortable about her daily life. Again, imagine walking every day in the palace, knowing that your predecessor had been killed for no good reason, and she's able to say, well, look, if this is really why I'm here in this very uncomfortable position for me at so many different levels, then let me at least be here in a way that can be of some service to the Jewish people. Now, of course, Ahasuerus immediately kills Haman, and he stops short of killing Esther. He doesn't necessarily react, but at the same time, he's still very leery of her. In fact, in the next chapter, when Esther goes in to bring up the subject of the Jews, because Ahasuerus doesn't seem to have registered that that was the issue. For him, it really wasn't the issue. She goes in, and the Megillah makes it very clear that she has to prostrate herself and beg Ahasuerus, you know, to begin to listen to the plight that the Jews are in. Right, messages have already been sent out that you have to kill the Jews. Ahasuerus is going to have to actively do something about that, and Esther knows it. One doesn't get the sense that Esther is, on intimate terms with Ahasuerus, that Esther is, you know, able to, you know, use some leverage or feel confident in her request. In fact, the Megillah makes it clear that the opposite is the case. Vatef gvatischanen lo. She's crying, she's begging. I think it's implicit in this interaction that there was considerable distance. You know, as a matter of fact, the only person by the end of the Megillah, and this I think makes a great deal of sense, the only person that Ahasuerus trusts at the end of the Megillah certainly isn't Esther, it's Mordechai, because Mordechai is the only one that he knows is loyal to him. He saved his life. So what Esther very wisely does is, now that the seeds of infidelity have been planted in Ahasuerus' mind, she knows that she has to at best withdraw herself from the picture. And Esther's final act, and this is really what chapter 8 is all about, vis-a-vis Ahasuerus, is installing Mordechai as the second in command. In other words, this highly suggestible, impulsive king. So Ahasuerus, you know, is essentially going to blow in the direction that whoever is around him. So by installing Mordechai there, better that Mordechai should be the number two than Haman should be the number two, and that's basically Esther's final act. From that point on, you know, after Esther has planted the seeds of doubt, seeds of infidelity in the mind of Ahasuerus, you know, her ability to influence things directly is really quite limited, as you would expect. And she withdraws, but Mordechai is able to emerge as the Jewish person in the palace. So they switch place in that way. Esther was, for a time, the Jewish person in the palace. She had her one moment, but she lived for that one moment. From that point on, it's going to have to be Mordechai. I think that transition comes into new perspective once you appreciate that she had played her last and only card. Once she's even raised the specter of infidelity, I don't think that she's really going to be in a position to recover than that. So just again, summarize the evidence that we accrued. Again, the first point that has to be stated is that Vashti is killed, and that Esther has to be walking around every day with a sense of basically when is the other shoe going to drop, and that she's at a certain point acclimated herself to the idea that I may be killed. That may inevitably be my fate, but I might as well die in such a way that could be a salvation to my people. That's point number one. Point number two, kasher avadati, avadati, sounds like Esther is saying, I'm resigned to die. It sounds like, to me, she's saying more than, he may not be willing to grant me entrance into the inner courtyard. It sounds like, either way, this cannot possibly end with me alive. Either he was going to reject me outright, or in the end, if I'm successful, if I'm able to implicate myself in Haman, so he'll kill both of us, and maybe that will be enough to at least begin the process of saving the Jews. Point number three, why else would she invite Haman? What point is there to have Haman right there? As I mentioned, there are about seven different answers in the Gemara. She was afraid that Ahasuerus might change his mind. You know, it may take him 5 minutes to go get Haman and hang him from wherever he was. So if he's right there, you know, that's helpful to Ahasuerus. Or, you know, kind of like, you know, keep your friends close and keep your enemies closer. There's no really good answer besides the one that I think that, you know, my favorite answer in the Gemara, the one I'm trying to suggest, is that she was trying to give off the impression to Ahasuerus that there was a lot going on that he was unaware of. And that, to my mind, seems to be corroborated by the first words out of his mouth, Hagam lichboshes hamalka imi babayis, suggesting that his entire, for the last 24 hours, entire being has been preoccupied with the idea, is this person that I trusted really betraying me? Is Haman betraying me? And therefore he kills Haman right away. He hasn't yet thought of what he's going to do about the Jews, as evidenced by chapter 8. You know, you would think at the end of chapter 7, okay, he kills Haman because he's angry about with the Jews. That's how we're raised reading his story, but it's nothing to do with why Ahasuerus killed Haman. Chapter 8 exists, and Esther withdraws, installs Mordechai, and, you know, just to conclude with this, and then I think Manny has a question, and just to conclude my remarks, is that the Gemara has, I think, a very apropos expression. The Gemara says, Yesh Adam Shekona Olamo Bishaachas, which means that there are some people who are in this world and their entire existence is justified by one triumphant moment. And they're really here for one thing. And for Esther, we know what that was, right? That her moment, Umiyodeya Imla Es Kazos, he got in the Machos, who knows, maybe it's for this one moment. What she did in really a 24-hour span, that's all there was between party one and party two. That moment, that singular moment, is kona olama b'sha'achat, that she established her immortal legacy to all of Jewish history in a 24-hour period. As she's like the archetype of that type of person to me, that recognized that there was a moment, that she was indispensable to that moment, was self-sacrificial in that moment, and ultimately, you know, we don't hear very much about her, you know, after anywhere else in Tanakh or what have you, but for that moment, she really is immortalized. There's no way that anybody outside the palace could have known what her thought process was and what was really going on. Even Mordechai, who encourages her to go see the king, does not do so in a specific way. It doesn't tell her what to say or what to do. So it can certainly be said that Esther, through her own intuition and through her own volition, was able to approach the king in a completely self-sacrificial way, where she says, I've thought, since I stepped foot in this palace, that he's going to kill me one day, I might as well die in such a way that's going to save my people. And that kind of self-sacrifice is an extremely poignant thing. Apropos last week, it's even more impressive coming from Esther. because if there's anything more impressive than the fact that she was willing to give up her life, it's the fact that Esther, who is the queen of modesty, quite literally, and the only modest person in an incredibly exposed culture of what's going on in Ahasuerus's Persia, the truth of the matter is that for Esther to have to die by insinuating a lack of morality on her part, or an infidelity, must have been an extremely, extremely difficult thing. She's not just going to be giving up her life, but in a very particular way, her legacy, her sense of character, sense of right, and her willingness to part with even that, because it's in the interest of the Jewish people, I think, is a subtlety, but an additional layer of heroism, you know, within a completely self-sacrificial act. Yeah, many.
Is there any definite statement here?